In the Moment is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 26th to 28th in Spearfish.
The U.S. government is not seizing businesses, but it is making deals that require a share of business profits. Is that capitalism or socialism? From SDPB, today is Tuesday, September 15th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, wealth advisor Rick Kaler joins the program. We'll talk about executive branch negotiations that seek to capture a share of private business profits for the American taxpayer. If the federal government is a shareholder, what does that mean for profit and innovation? Plus, after a debut season, competitive video gaming known as esports is South Dakota's largest sanctioned high school activity. But does it pass muster with the teachers? Teacher Talk looks at gaming and belonging later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment. News is first.
Business and Economy Reporting is supported by SDN Communications, your business broadband provider. More at sdncommunications.com.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. For today's financial session, we're going to explore the tenets of socialism and capitalism, and we'll look at a presidential action and ask, well, which one is it? Rick Kaler is a wealth advisor and founder of the Kaler Financial Group in Rapid City. All right, it is an interesting and noteworthy, if not plain old tough time to be in business right now. And you wrote a column about the U.S. government taking holdings or shares of American companies and really people asking you, well, wait a minute, isn't that socialism? So let's start with a little bit about what you have been hearing from your audience, whether that's clients or people who are responding to your blog or, your thoughts on this show. What are people wondering about socialism when it comes to the American government and business right now?
Yeah, as you can expect, it's a diverse response. You have one set of clients that are very concerned and are asking, wait a minute, the U.S. government coercing private businesses into giving up a slice of their revenue, as was the case in two situations, or an actual 10% ownership of the company in another. And it's unprecedented. And so there's concern around that. Is this socialism? The other response is, isn't this a great idea? This is a way to get revenue into the government and partner with companies and a support for it.
So the U.S. Commerce Secretary said America should have a share of some of these things. But sometimes the government can be the largest shareholder in a company. Like, what's going on here? Where do you want to begin unpacking this?
Where do I want to begin? Okay.
Yeah.
It's not socialism. This is not socialism. Some of us call a lot of things socialism that is not socialism. The most common thing is referring to the Scandinavian countries as socialists.
Okay.
They are not. They have markets. They have a degree of capitalism. They have really high taxes and really broad social nets. But they're not socialism. Socialism is where the government owns all of the aspects of production. They own the companies. They own the real estate. They own everything. So that's true socialism. This is also not capitalism. Capitalism does not have government interference, does not have government ownership of companies. So what is this? And this is what confounded me when I went to China, I don't know, 10 years ago or so. I'm like, what is this? You got the Communist Party, but they have a degree of capitalism. And I couldn't get my head around how does this work? And in my usual way of prognosticating that didn't work out well, I figured, well, this isn't going to last. give them 10 years and this whole thing will have collapsed. What I didn't understand is that this is something in between socialism and capitalism, and it's called state capitalism. And in state capitalism, the government has a profound influence, even ownership of companies, but the markets remain open. So you still have shares traded on the exchange. You still have individual owners of the of those companies. So, and in this case, I will call what we're seeing coerced state capitalism, because it was not, it was kind of more along the lines of blackmail, you know, coercion.
Because grants were up for, you know, in order to get these grants, you have to give government ownership some control.
So yeah, they had been approved and hadn't been funded. And finally, it's like, well, you know, maybe we'll fund them if you give us 15% of the revenue. The request was for 20% of the revenue in the case of Nevada and AMD, and that was negotiated down to 15%. And this is striking because we're talking about gross revenue. There's many companies that don't have a 15 or 20% profit margin. I mean, this is money off the top. So that's huge. And how is that going to be paid? Let's just say that they had a 10% profit margin. Well, clearly, you can't run in the hole and be in business. So prices are going to have to go up.
What did shareholders have to say about this?
I don't know.
But
I have not been tuned to those circles.
Yeah.
I don't know. If I was a shareholder, I wouldn't be very happy with it. Yeah. But ultimately, it's the consumer that's going to pay. And demand will fall because prices go up. The money's got to come from somewhere.
Yeah.
And in the case of Intel, it's a 10% share. So they're sharing in the profits of the company because they own 10% of the company. So it's the profits that fall down to the shareholders. And the U.S. government becomes the largest shareholder in Intel. So this is state capitalism. And I can kind of internally go off the rails with stuff like this. As I led a session at a recent think tank brainstorming group that meets once a year, and it was on facts and fiduciary. What's our responsibility as financial planners, financial therapists, to lean into facts? Mm-hmm. Because that can be very difficult. And one guy says, you know, I have a wall full of certificates saying that I'm an expert in this stuff. And yet I'm being told that it's fake news today. And this stuff is something as simple as a tariff is a tax. And I watched, I got back Monday and I watched one of the Talking Head programs, Meet the Press, with the Treasury Secretary, Bessent. And he absolutely and clearly said a tariff was not a tax.
Right, yeah.
This blows up my little South Dakota mind. Not a certificate I'm looking at on my wall that says I had to pass a test on what that was.
Yeah.
And so this is kind of what we're up against with this. But going back to what's going on, this is state capitalism. So I have parts of myself that can just go off the rails and, you know, Katie barred the door, last person out, turn off the lights. We're going to nowhere. And yet the market's at near all-time highs.
So you're rethinking the things that you know for sure and the context that you have built over education, training, certification, and experience. And you bringing that context into the current political environment as you really watch the politicization of business decisions. This is different than them, you know, people are mad at a retail outlet because they carry a product or because they don't carry a product, or so that the customers set up a boycott of Starbucks or, you know, whomever. That's different than that because that's the free market, right? This is, you know, government influence, which is a little bit different than, you know, a Facebook boycott. But business has become incredibly political.
And incredibly so.
And what are some of the pressures then? How can you, you know, update your own software? How can we update our own, you know, mental software a little bit to try to navigate this time?
So in a column that has yet to appear, I address this.
I love it when you give us a preview. Oh, yeah.
And I decided, okay, what does state capitalism look like? What are the returns of a company where many of the countries are owned by the state? So I did a little research with my friend ChatGPT. And I checked some of his sources, and it looked like he was having a good day. And I took the last 10 years of returns in the US market, and I compared them to the last 10 years of returns in, I think it was 4 to 6 countries that have state capitalism. The largest being, of course, China. I was kind of surprised that the second largest was Norway. And if I remember the stats right, 37% of all companies in Norway have some government ownership. And I think Saudi Arabia was one, and there were several others. And here's what I found. The average return on U.S. stocks in the last 10 years was 12.5% with a 16% standard deviation. Now, going back to your eighth grade stats class, standard deviation is the swing. Mm-hmm. The volatility. So meaning if you have an average return of 12, you add 16%, it could be as high as 28. You take away 16, it could be as low as -4. That's the normal range that okay. returns are going to fall. In these countries, the highest return during that same 10-year period was 6%. The lowest return was 3.5%. So what I think we can confidently say, at least compared to the U.S. market, is, and there are other factors in here. I'm simplifying this, but I think it gets across the point. The world didn't end if you were investing in a company in a country that had state capitalism. Your returns were lower, and the standard deviations were 18.5% to 24.5%, meaning you got lower return for more risk, lower return for higher volatility. Now, as an investment advisor, that's not what we're out looking for.
Right.
We want the opposite, high return, low volatility. But the world didn't end. And I think this looks like the path that the current administration is on. To what degree this goes, I don't know. But I have Chinese securities in my benchmarks, in my investments. It doesn't make up much. The Chinese market doesn't make up much of the world. They're considered an emerging market. Norway, some shares in Norway, but they don't make up much of the world's capitalization. So it makes sense to hold shares in those countries in one's portfolio. And it helped me internally kind of regulate okay, this isn't the end of the world. What we can do is just prepare for a 50% cut in returns with more volatility. And then now that can easily be plugged into your financial plan or your retirement plan to say, yeah, I'd better cut my going forward expectations of return. And we're not seeing that in the market today, but we're only talking about U.S. Steel was another company that joined them. And then I see there's more of this in the works. So I think that's the balanced way to approach it, is I just kind of need to rethink my going forward returns, my retirement income, and prepare for this. And the other thing, I don't know if I said it in these columns that ran, is a person absolutely needs to be diversified. In other words, of stuff that's in stocks, 50% of it can be in the U.S., but 50% needs to be in the world in general. Hmm. You do not want to be 100% in the U.S.
So will investors start asking questions about ownership, like governmental ownership? Because, I mean, if I had a portfolio, I'd be asking, is it a good time to get into Intel? Or if I had a bunch of shares, is it a good time to get out of it? You mentioned diversifying internationally, but how about diversifying here at home with the companies that I have investments in on the continent?
What I would recommend is buying a mutual fund that invests in a broad base. Like we use one mutual fund that has 12 or 13,000 different stocks in it. Mm. Now, some of that owns NVIDIA and AMD and Intel, but right now that is a drop in the bucket. So I would not be investing directly into stocks, because then answering the questions that you pose become just mind-numbing. Watch Intel double in price. I mean, markets are hard to predict.
Right.
And we can just say, in general, this probably won't turn out well for the shareholders of those companies. But short term, you can never predict anything. I mean, I was the guy back in when we were talking in March and April saying, yeah, the chances of a recession have gone from 15 to 60%. Things are not looking good at all. And then things got better. The market went to new highs. Well, now today we're starting to see cracks, and the jobs reports actually went negative 1 month. And we're starting to see, I think, pretty good signs of a recession coming. This just takes time. And the market is never on my timeline. But what we're seeing happen with the tariffs, we're seeing that starting to wash through. We're seeing companies like John Deere and a number of companies with falling profits because of that. So that takes time. And we've talked a lot about, one thing I can say assuredly is we will have a recession. What I can't say assuredly is when.
That was wealth advisor Rick Kaler with the Kaler Financial Group. You can find this blog post and more on his website. We'll have a link with this In the Moment episode on sdpb.org/news. Up next, esports in South Dakota schools. Teacher Talk is after the break. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB.
Sports and Recreation Reporting on SDPB is supported by Southeast Technical College. Get your degree, get to work.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Last year, South Dakota held its first ever state-sanctioned esports tournament. Esports offers students a diverse extracurricular activity option. With the growing popularity of esports, we asked Caleb Deshock to join us for a conversation. Deshock is the CEO and founder of Fenworks. That's an esports company that provides programming for students and facilitates school esports competitions. He joined us via Zoom. Gina Benz is a high school teacher at Roosevelt in Sioux Falls. She's also an adjunct professor at the University of Sioux Falls and the University of South Dakota. She has more than 25 years of experience in the classroom. Jackie Wilbur is a faculty member and director of the Senate of Student and Professional Services at the University of South Dakota's School of Education. Here's our conversation. Caleb Deshock, welcome to Teacher Talk. Thanks for stopping by.
So thank you for having me.
Before we get into the meat of our conversation here, I'm wondering if you might just tell us a little bit about your company, Fenworks, and then we'll ask you a few questions about how you found your way into this field. But tell us about the company and how it connects with South Dakota first, please.
Absolutely. Fenworks is a high-tech activity company. So our objective is to help educators, help communities as they take the next step in supporting future generations of sport, of play, and of activity. And so it's really exciting to support things like esports, drone racing, high-tech activities like hackathons, and even new sorts of coursework that help educators and students, you know, find where they belong and what makes them successful.
Tell us a little bit about how you found your way into esports?
Yeah, I've been gaming since I was probably 3 years old, maybe 4 years old. I mean, some of my earliest memories are sitting on my dad's lap and playing classic video games on Atari and the first Nintendo. And I mean, just a genuine love and passion that started with the family. Really growing up, it was a great way for me to stay connected with friends. My whole family gamed. And then in college, I had the opportunity to compete at my first esports competition. So I went to downtown Grand Forks, North Dakota. DACNA was putting on an esports tournament. I got a team. We competed and we took second place out of two teams. But it was still one of the things that sparked this joy and this love for me. And all of that has led to what we've built right here in the Midwest with FenWorks.
Explain to parents before we really get into this what esports is. Your kid comes home and is like, I want to be on the esports team. And the parents go, huh?
Wait a second. Well, I mean, it's a great question. Esports is the competitive side of video gaming. Oftentimes it means that you're part of a team where you're using leadership and teamwork and communication to achieve objectives in these games. You're going a real team of real humans against another team. And in South Dakota, that means South Dakota students and South Dakota schools versus other South Dakota schools. Very similar to traditional sports and traditional activities, where you have practices and then the big game day and then the big state tournament at the end.
Hmm. All right. Gina, tell me a little bit about your relationship with esports. When did you start? Because you've been teaching for more than 25 years.
But
how new is esports to
I
you?
I just got hooked into esports this past year. And Caleb, how long has esports been sanctioned in South Dakota?
Yeah, I think we're going on our third year between pilot and full sanctioning in South Dakota. So sanctioned for three, I think.
So my school got its esports coach last year and had the first year of forming a team. So we had a pretty small team. But one of my students, Will Ristow, became the chess state champion through esports.
Woo!
Yeah. And another one of my students, Austin Markman, got third place in Rocket League. 3-on-3
wow.
Rocket League. Okay, so here's the deal. Will is a quiet type of guy, but he's really good at chess. And so when he won the state championship, I announced it to my class, and everyone cheered for him and clapped for him. They were so excited for him. They gave him a cool nickname about being a champion. And, you know, this quiet guy, Will, he represented our school. Right? He was a part of something bigger than himself, and he represented us with pride and contributed to the school community. And then we got Austin, who was supposed to be he was slated to be a really important player on our football team. The game or two I got to watch before he got injured, he was getting the ball a lot. And I watched when he got injured, and he was done. He blew out his knee. I don't know, ACL, MCL. All of it, I don't know, but he was done. And so I've seen so many students when their athletic careers end, they're lost. They don't know what to do with themselves anymore because those athletes put in a lot of time. They invest time, money, all of it. And sometimes they don't even know who they are anymore. Austin, however, was like, all right, I got these lemons. I'm going to make lemonade. And he joined esports. And later, at the end of the year, he joined tennis, which I don't think he'd done before. And so he was like, I'll try some new things. And he got third in the Rocket League. And I went up and to our computer room where this happens and watched. And it was exciting. I stayed. I didn't think I'd stay as long as I would. I cheered. I jumped out of my seat. So I'm hooked because esports is a great place for kids to belong to the school and contribute to the school community in ways that maybe weren't always possible for all kids. Research shows students have better attendance, better social lives, better experiences in school when they're connected to a part of school that is voluntary, not the legal part where you have to attend school, but you have chosen to be a part of even more of school.
All right. Explain Rocket League, Caleb. What exactly is that?
Yeah, this is actually great. There are so many different titles that people compete in. Rocket League is one of the best, though, because fans of the students can watch a match of Rocket League and understand what's going on the screen. In its simplest format, It is 3v3 soccer. Instead of players, it's cars with rockets strapped to their back. And so you're trying to make goals, you're trying to defend goals. Really easy for parents, grandparents, and loved ones and community members to look at the screen, know what's going on in that esport title.
And it's in like a bowl, not a field, but a bowl, so that you can go up the wall, you can flip around. And then there's a lot of strategy involved. Like, this is not kids just, you know, mindlessly playing a game. They are strategically helping each other, blocking things, passing things, and teamwork.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You've nailed it. The communication is so important in esports. The games have grown so much over the last 20 years that the strategy components, the research components, the educational components, and we see so many more people are gaming because they can be engaged, their minds are activated, and they're socially activated. And that's so important when it comes to any activity, but especially new ones in the 21st century.
So, Jackie Wilbur, tell me a little bit about your experience with esports.
I have minimal experience with esports other than preparing for today. Other than I personally am a fan of chess and I watch chess on Twitch. And then as a member of the University of South Dakota, we have our own esports arena on campus and there's scholarships available. So I've thought a lot about the pathways that are now getting created for students as a way from going the same way other activities and other sports are a way into secondary, post-secondary education, higher education, that is happening for esports as well.
So does USD then and all universities and colleges in South Dakota really have to consider what they're offering in the esports arena because, literally and figuratively, but because students are looking for it?
Absolutely. And we have a really beautiful esports arena. You can tour it on our website. If you look up esports at USD, you can take a virtual tour and see the space and see all of the different.
So it's a physical space.
It's a physical space.
What happens in the physical space?
I haven't been into the physical space, but it seems like every other sports. Well, I mean, and Caleb, I would be curious to know for folks who are trying to get invested and started themselves, like, what do you need to have an esports team at your school?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're absolutely correct. The physical space is this opportunity to take an activity that is primarily online, right? But bring it into the real world. As a gamer, and I've been a gamer since, you know, before I can even remember being a gamer, it's always been this online thing or this thing that I've done by myself. But more and more, it's online. It's with friends, though. It's a social activity. And right now, I can play with my friends from my home and they're playing from their home. That's something that I can already do. But when high schools, when middle schools, when colleges, when our communities create these spaces that I as a nerd and a gamer can come to and compete at, it really makes it real. It connects me back to my community. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why we see colleges adopt these spaces, because so many young people and so much of the next generation are gamers. And so that can look like a variety of different things. That can be 5, 10, 15, 20 gaming PCs. That can look like a PlayStation 5 and the new Xbox and the Switch 2 on a couple of the screens there. And so it's just this space that's filled with activity, that's filled with socializing, that's filled with people that allow us to embrace these hobbies that we've been doing at home. I mean, imagine if basketball, the only type of basketball that was happening was just the hoop that you have on your garage at home. There was no spaces, there was no courts for you to go and compete at. Well, that's very much where we're at with esports right now, but slowly we're coming out of our shell and building those community facilities that make us feel like we belong, whether that's at college or in our communities.
Caleb, help us understand then for kids who don't have access to gaming tools at home, don't have devices or equipment or internet connectivity, how do you make sure this isn't just a sport that invites kids who have a certain amount of means?
Yeah. When we talk about access, this is a really important topic. Now, the survey data is a little bit all over the place, but what we see is almost every student that we have surveyed has access to a video game device. Now, is it at the caliber that they need to compete? Is their internet at the caliber that they need to compete at? That's the part that is sometimes missing. And so it is important that as we continue to build this activity, school districts are looking at their facilities and saying, okay, how do we make sure that we have a STEM lab? And I think that's the genius of esports. This is an activity that does require some hardware. It does require these computers, but it's not like they have to be used just for esports. These gaming computers are basically STEM machines. Mm. So across South Dakota, we use drone racing simulations on these esports machines. CAD and other types of STEM classes in computer science and cybersecurity classes can leverage these machines. And there's just going to be more activities that are going to require access to a GPU, one of the components inside these computers. So as time goes on, we need that local communities to support and to build these facilities. And when it comes to the connectivity, we have seen really great success. SDN has been one of the biggest supporters of esports in the state of South Dakota, and them and they and their member companies have done a great job supporting local school districts with grants to get esports programs going and off the ground.
So, Gina, tell me a little bit about how it works at Roosevelt.
The season starts in November. Am I right, Caleb?
Yep, correct.
And then the state tournament, state championship, will be in February this year in Aberdeen, just like last year. And if anyone's interested in what that looks like, you can go to the post I did on the blog. I have a few pictures from my students. You also links to the FenWorks website so you can see videos and images. Even if you do a YouTube search, you can watch the whole awards ceremony. Anyhow, so the students start practicing. They gather. They determine who will be playing what games. They have uniforms. They have their schedule when they compete with other schools, and they just work to go to that state championship and take home some hardware.
Yeah. So another question I'm sure you get from parents a lot is, you know, to be good at a sport or an activity, you need to practice it a lot. So if you're in theater, you need to show up for rehearsals. If you're on the tennis team, you need to show up for practice. And there's risks to all those things. You know, kids can get hurt. You know, things can happen on the field, on the court, on the stage. But with esports, of course, one of the big concerns is that much of it is sedentary. So, but if you're telling me that my kid wants to play this sport or be on this team, one of my first concerns is like, well, they're going to come home, they're going to want to practice, they're going to want to be at rehearsals, it's more sitting, more sitting, more sitting. So Caleb, help me understand how you address that in the context, in the overall context of esports, especially as you're communicating with parents.
Yeah, great question. And that is absolutely a valid concern. And so one of the things when I started my career in esports at the University of North Dakota was we built our esports program right into the wellness center. That's where it started. And so it was an opportunity to do intramural programming and to educate students on campus about the importance of healthy gaming, healthy activities, diet, nutrition, exercise, and all of those things that sometimes have been missed. And so as we do work in the K-12 space, that is still a huge part of our mission, is to make sure that we're educating students and parents and folks who might not be in our traditional activities about the importance of those healthy behaviors. But there's also a little bit more happening underneath the hood as well. What we're seeing is, for a lot of these students, esports is the first activity that they have done at their school district. But what is happening is once they've started esports, these students are interacting with the coach, they're interacting with assistant coaches, and they're interacting with students who are a part of activities. So more and more, we're hearing stories from students who started in esports, but then also pick up a spring track season, or they pick up a fall sport. And so by getting them engaged and bought in to their community and into their school district, we have an opportunity to do interventionary programming to get those students more bought in into the school culture and into the school community, including all those healthy behaviors. And in addition, by having just one season of esports, we have our esports season, so we get to, you know, give students that opportunity to engage in something that they love doing, but we leave the rest of the calendar year open so that they can engage in other activities that get them out and active as well. And many of our schools have even looked to incorporate a physical activity as part of their esports club, whether that's a walk warm-up or a run warm-up or push-ups or sit-ups or anything like that. There's one other thing that we're really proud to talk about as well, which is this last year, we've also been able to partner with Special Olympics South Dakota to launch our unified esports. And we actually were able to hand out medals at the state tournament hosted by South Dakota High School Activities for those students in Special Olympics esports. And so when we talk about accessibility And when we talk about getting students active and engaged in things they love, it's important that we look at the health benefits, and it's also important to look at who can engage in this sport and activity so that everyone has a place where they belong.
There is more to this conversation. After the break, we'll talk about the impact of esports as it prepares students for higher education and career readiness. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You are listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We return to our conversation on esports in schools. I'm joined by Teacher Talk educators Jackie Wilbur and Gina Benz. Our guest is Caleb DeShock. He's CEO and founder of Fenworks. Jackie, what are some of your questions about this?
Yeah, I'm just curious to know what else you're seeing. What other trends are developing? What are you noticing as esports has continued to grow? What else is the data telling you?
Yeah, we're hearing a lot from educators, from students, as they become career ready or choice ready to go into higher education or into workforce or into other fields of service. Upon graduation, that there's a lot more well-roundedness around the STEM and the computer science side of things. So it's really exciting to see that this activity is promoting some of that STEM education, and a lot of school districts are using esports as an opportunity to promote that STEM education. So that's a big piece from the career readiness perspective. We're also just seeing a lot of really powerful stories in communities across South Dakota. And all of our communities, public schools, private schools, tribal schools, eastern schools, western schools, big schools, small schools, we're seeing a lot of anecdotal evidence coming out that educators are seeing some of these students. Again, we often hear stories of quieter students, students who maybe have not been active or engaged in the school community before getting active and engaged. So those are really powerful stories.
What's the connection between gaming and STEM? Because playing Super Mario Kart is not math, it's not engineering, it's not science.
Right.
It's technology, but it's very frictionless.
Right. I think one of the big pieces is when you're passionate and engaged in the gaming space, let's say, and you want to get further into that pathway, because you're gaming on, normally, especially for PC gamers, because you're gaming on PC, it's pretty easy and seamless to dabble in computer science, whether that's modding video games, whether that's getting into stats as you begin to look at your League of Legends win rate and loss rate and analyze the data based off of what character you play or what items you purchase in a single round. Those kind of pieces of information make students curious learners, and those skill sets also carry out throughout their educational experience. And then we also see that there's a lot of parallels to students who get involved in esports and then take on another STEM activity like robotics or like drone racing. And drone racing has even clearer parallels to career readiness, STEM education, workforce readiness, when it comes to students engaging, students pursuing their Part 107 license, students learning about drone technology. So for a very long time, if you talk to drone operators across the country, for the longest time, there weren't exactly programs recruiting or training these operators. So one of their questions on the resumes and during the job application process was, are you a gamer? Because the skill sets carried over quite nicely. So we're seeing that there's a lot of tangential relationship to STEM without engaging in those other areas that I talked about. But those are the areas where you really see the STEM integration with esports come alive.
It seems to me like it's a, for lack of a better term, a gateway drug. It's the start of a student becoming more interested in technology, or it's the start of a student becoming more engaged in their school community for a lot.
Absolutely.
And you're seeing that in the classroom.
I am seeing that personally.
Are you a gamer?
Oh, no.
Yeah, okay.
No.
So it's not that you have some big background. You're just watching it as an educator.
I'm just so impressed, and I'm not a gamer. Yeah. But it's obvious how impressive it is. And let me say, too, like, I'm even a little choked up right now as I'm thinking about some of the people I know who are a part of esports. And you mentioned the unified esports, which, for the audience, what that means is you have students of varying abilities. You have students who are maybe in the special ed program and who have some real profound disabilities, mixing with the whole student body.
With the football player who just got injured.
That didn't happen in that case, but it could be.
Theoretically.
Yes, theoretically. And it's a really beautiful thing how the whole school comes together, no matter, you know, what your abilities and disabilities are. Let me just say, though, at Roosevelt, we have unified show choir. We have unified basketball. And our unified basketball plays Jefferson's unified basketball team.
Okay, sure.
And our unified show choir competes at show choir competitions. And it's just, it's a beautiful thing. And I know, too, that I know of a student in Bridgewater who probably wouldn't be able to be on many activities because of what's going on with him. But esports is where he can contribute and be part of his school and represent his school. And honestly, it chokes me up.
Yeah. What do you want the future of this to be, Gina? What do you think the school itself should invest in, whether that means a financial investment or just a, you know, a social investment in the esports team?
Well, I like how Caleb said a lot of the financial investment can also carry over to classes that we offer.
Yeah.
And so I would like to see it grow. Roosevelt got second in the state last year. Super proud of my kids. First place won, like they were way ahead of everybody else, though. And that was Dakota Valley.
Dakota Valley.
And they had, what did they have?
I thought it was Lincoln.
Lincoln, I think, got third. Oh. Caleb, do you happen to know?
I'm thinking back to it. Dakota Valley was our overall state champion and walked away with a lot of bling and trophies as well. And I think you nailed it on the head. There's a lot of investment and pride that Dakota Valley takes into their esports program. Yeah. They were really a early on dedicated program and believed in this. The activities director, the IT directors, the career tech ed people, I think that whole community really banded together to put their school district on the map when it comes to esports. And I'm just so curious how many scholarships their varsity players are going to take home when they go off to college.
Yeah, it's true. And when I watched the awards ceremony on YouTube, their team is huge compared to the other teams.
Huge.
There's so many kids who are participating and being a part of their school.
Yeah. Other questions that you have, Gina?
I want to know nationally, do you know how many states, or at least do you know, can you give us more states that are sanctioning esports?
I will hopefully be announcing a state sanctioning esport here in the next month or so.
Exciting.
But I mean, yes, we are seeing more and more states look at what is the right way to do esports. How do they get more students active and engaged? In the Midwest, it's a little bit less, but I mean, the East Coast and West Coast has done a lot in terms of sanctioning over the last few years. So in the Midwest, South Dakota has actually been fully a leader in this space. South Dakota said, we're not waiting on anybody else to do this first out here. We're going to put the flag in the ground and say that South Dakota is going to represent. And I mean, you look at that nationally, more and more young people are looking at their varsity programs and junior varsity programs for esports and saying, this is what I want my K-12 experience to look like. But I think what you're also seeing is more higher education institutions are realizing that this is not just a nice to have, but a requirement to be a competitive college here in 2025. Yeah. So I think you're going to continue to see it grow in that aspect. And the final thing that we're missing is the community space. So in North Dakota, I as an adult have really no esports events I can compete in my state. South Dakota has the SDN circuit held in Sioux Falls. And that's a great event where hundreds and thousands of people drive from miles and miles away, because it's one of the only ways that as an adult, I can get a team together, get my friends together and compete in something real. And you're going to see more of that growing as well. So a lot to look forward to.
Like the Bar Kickball League.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
All right. I'm on the right track here.
But I like you said this, Caleb, how we're moving people out of their basements and living rooms into a community of gamers.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. You mentioned, you know, what is the right way? States asking themselves, what is the right way to sanction esports? So what is the wrong way? In other words, what are some of the pitfalls that you would recommend? Hey, avoid this, avoid that, avoid the other.
The reality is esports requires a lot of culture building and a lot of work for it to go successfully. I mean, we've seen a lot of states across the nation try to launch esports, but without the resources required. And we see really high forfeit rates. And that isn't good for students. I mean, imagine, you know, your kids and you drive halfway across the state to face another team in football, and then the other team just doesn't show up. I mean, we really are at the beginning of building a fully new activity in a medium that we haven't used before. So it's incredible. I mean, we saw the launch of girls wrestling, and that has been a phenomenal addition. We're seeing flag football launch. But both of those activities, they really already are understandable. The changes are not enormous, but with esports, we're talking about a lot of new things that need to be done to successfully run those activities. And so, you know, Fenworks hosts a coaching clinic in every state that we provide services. That's a real world coaching clinic. We held it in Dakota Valley this year so that we could train the educators on recruitment, on building the programs, on the game titles, on how to use the software, how to successfully run programs or run fundraisers, engage their booster club. So everything that we know in traditional activities has just decades of history to sort of carry them forward. We have to build all of that and all of that culture, and we're doing it right now in the first 3 years. But I'm also really excited to say that we're going to look back on this and realize that we were part of building something that is going to be, I mean, thought about in the same way as basketball and track and field and speech and debate and, you know, others.
I think of my grandmother who played basketball in like the 1920s, and she always said, I played basketball in the black bloomers. Like, that's what they had to wear. Northwest Iowa, this is. And you have to wonder 100 years from now, some kid who's playing now is going to be like, I was the first. Yeah. And this is what our uniforms look like. And this is the equipment that we had. And it's going to be completely different ways that maybe can't imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's paralleling the way career development is happening and the way we're evolving as a society about the different kinds of jobs that are becoming available.
Right.
I was even thinking, too, like there is a direct correlation between being on the high school esports chess team, and you can go on to become a professional chess player. You know, that is a real job that people have now. Not that they didn't before, but I feel like in a new way with things like Twitch, people are watching it professionally and being professional commentators in the same way they can kind of go into other sports arenas. Or the robotics team, you can be in robotics later on in your life.
So. Do you have, I hate to put you on the spot with this, Jackie, but he mentioned, Caleb mentioned culture building.
Yeah.
And that seems to me something that you have thought about before in other. Is there a parallel to like how you build a culture of a school, a culture of a classroom? Let's talk about that for a minute with Jimmy and Jackie. Yeah.
Well, culture building is so interesting to me, and I think it's incredibly important to building a classroom community and to being the leader in an educational space. And so what you're doing with your coaches, with your esports coaches, I think is fundamental to the success of it, because you need students to buy in to what's happening there. And so if they can understand the why and where it's getting them, and it sounds like, I mean, just talking about it, I know the types of students that are going to be interested in esports have this like natural interest. And so to just develop the cultural community of like we have this shared passion and shared interest, I think is key to the success of it.
And Gina, you mentioned something earlier about contributing to your school.
Well, yeah,
some people don't think about that. How are you going to make your school better than when you arrived?
Well, that's, you just said it, right? How are you going to leave this place better than how you found it? And I guess that's just always been the culture at my school, that you'll try to leave the place better than how you found it. It's what I try to promote in my own classroom.
Probably most classrooms of,
I would
of
think
teachers
so.
Who are listening. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so what it does is it promotes community. And I think one of the best things about a school is that you come together, people who are really, really different. We serve the public, and the public is really diverse and different. You come together for a common cause. You come together to be part of something greater than yourself.
Mm. That was Caleb DeShock, CEO and founder of Fenworks, along with our Teacher Talk educators, Dr. Jackie Wilbur and Gina Benz. Listen to the full Teacher Talk segment online at SDPB's Teacher Talk podcast. You can find that at sdpb.org/teachertalk or on your favorite podcast platform. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ari Youngerman and Ellen Kester.
I'm your host, Lori Walsh, from all of us here at SDPB. Thank you for listening.